Welcome to another broadcast of Studying the Scriptures. I'm your host, Dr. Todd Baker, Director of Berit Hadashah Ministries in Dallas, Texas. On today's program, we are going to look at the ninth and final feasts in our study of the Feast of Israel. And that would be the Feast of Purim. Purim, which is simply translating from Hebrew to English, the Feast of Lots. Purim is a feast that reminds the world and the Jewish people that God is the protector and defender of the nation of Israel, and that anti-Semitism will severely and swiftly be punished by the God of Israel. Anti-Semitism is nothing new to modern history. For from the Exodus until this very hour, Satan has used individuals, leaders, kings, queens, all kinds of potentates, government officials, artists, musicians, the whole gambit of human history. We have example after example of anti-Semitism from every place, from every corner in the world. And the purpose for anti-Semitism is satanic in origin. It comes from Satan, who desires to extirpate and annihilate the Jewish people so that God's plan for man, utilized and actuated through the Jewish people, could be destroyed. And that plan, of course, culminates in the salvation of mankind through the Jewish Messiah. And in order to have a Jewish Messiah, the Jewish people who comprise the nation of Israel must exist. Satan, knowing that he will suffer defeat and has suffered defeat at the hands of the Jewish Messiah, then attempts to destroy the Jewish people to circumvent God's plan against him from succeeding. It's so very simple. And we have this dramatically played out with the Feast of Purim and the historical context it is found in. And it is found in the historical section of the Old Testament in the book of Esther. And Haman serves as an example for all anti-Semites throughout human history, that whoever seeks to plot, conspire, and attempt to destroy the Jewish people will in the end bring about their own demise and destruction. Ironically, Purim was an attempt by an individual like Haman to carry out a final solution against the Jewish people, when it only served in the end as a cause for celebration by the Jewish people, acknowledging God's deliverance of them from the evil designs of Haman. Hence we have the institution of the Feast of Purim. Purim reminds the Jewish people, not only during the days of Queen Esther, but throughout history, that those who would oppose and seek to destroy the Jewish people, those who advocate and advance anti-Semitism, whether it be Egypt and his Pharaoh, whether it be Haman, Hitler, or the PA and the Arab world, all those who seek to destroy Israel will in the end be defeated and destroyed themselves. In every instance where the devil has tried to use anti-Semitism on a major level, God has turned around and deflected such venom and brought about good results for the Jewish people in the end. Case in point, when Pharaoh sought to destroy the Hebrew nation in ancient Egypt by demanding that every male Hebrew child born be killed, the Lord brought about the Exodus and the creation of the nation of Israel. When Haman sought to destroy the Jewish people, God brought about their miraculous deliverance, and the Feast of Purim was instituted because of it and is observed every year by the Jewish nation since that time. When Hitler implemented his final solution, the Allies stormed Germany, destroyed the city of Berlin, and the Führer resorted to the cowardly act of suicide. That resulted 3 short years later, after the war ended in 1945. In 1948, the State of Israel was born, and it is annually celebrated on their Independence Day. So the Jewish Feast of Purim is a feast that commemorates God's protection and defense of His people against their enemies who seek nothing less than their destruction. The Feast of Purim is the ninth feast on the Jewish calendar. It is one of the most happy, joyous, and fun holidays because it commemorates a time when the Jewish people were on the verge of extermination. Purim is the Hebrew word for lots. The singular form for lot is pur. When you add the yod and the mem, or the I and the M, if it's transliterated into English, that makes it plural. Purim. Lots. The Feast of Lots. And the feast is commemorative of the fact that though the wicked Haman, and we will look at the personalities of Purim later on, and we'll get into detail about Haman, but suffice it to say now, the feast recalls how the wicked Haman determined to destroy the Jewish people, and he cast lots to determine the month and day on which the Jewish people were to be killed throughout the vast Persian Empire. And the lots fell on the very day that Purim would be celebrated. And so the Feast of Purim falls annually on the 14th day of Adar. That's when the Jewish people were supposed to be destroyed, because the lots that Haman cast fell on the 13th of Adar. And later, of course, it became the day on which God delivered the Jewish people, and henceforth the annual day for the celebration of Purim. Purim is a late winter feast. It's also known as the Feast of Esther or Mordecai's Day, as we learn from 2 Maccabees 15:36. And basically, Purim commemorates the deliverance of God's people by the hands of Esther and Mordecai. Purim usually falls in late February, early to mid-March. It is the last feast of the biblical year. It falls on the 14th day of Adar, the 12th Hebrew month. In Jerusalem, Purim is celebrated on Adar 15, one day later than in the rest of the world. This is because, according to Esther 9:18, the Jews in the ancient capital of Susa or Shushan did not rest from fighting their enemies until the following day, which would be Adar 15. And so Adar 15 is also known as Shushan Purim. Purim, of course, is an extra feast outside of the Torah, where in Leviticus 23 we have the seven feasts of Israel. Despite this, however, Purim is a biblical feast and one of the best known Jewish holidays added and celebrated since the completion of Torah by Moses. We certainly have the historical context and background for the emergence of Purim given to us in one of the canonical books of the Bible. Esther is part of the Old Testament canon, and that is where we read about the events that led to the institution of Purim. Now, let me say that even though the book of Esther is not included in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is the collection of the books from the Old Testament canon, it was nevertheless accepted as biblical, certainly by the time of the first century in Israel. And Jews of that time, including Jesus and his contemporaries, accepted the book of Esther as biblical and therefore part of the canon of the Tanakh or Old Testament. One of the reasons why Esther was questioned as being canonical by the ancient rabbis and Jewish sages of Israel is the fact that the Lord's name is not mentioned anywhere in the book of Esther. God is not mentioned by name, or the divine Lord is not mentioned either. None of the divine names of the God of Israel are found in the book of Esther. However, there is an overriding divine providence whose unseen hand directs and controls the events of Esther. And so the question that can be posed, if this book is part of the canon of Scripture, why the omission? Why the conspicuous omission of God and any reference to Him? There's a twofold answer to this, and I think it is best summed up by the great Bible commentator H. A. Ironside. He says this: first, in this book we have Israel and what was really a self-chosen path, for opportunity had been given to return to the land of their fathers, there to rebuild the city of God, but they preferred to remain where they were rather than endure the hardship of immigrating to Canaan. They were in Persia and Babylon when they might have been in Palestine. He says Palestine here, I would say the land of Israel. Gathered around God's center at Jerusalem. Second, the great subject of Esther is evidently the secret providence, a particular providence too, which is ever watching over the scattered nation during all the long drawn out times of the Gentiles. So rather than return to the land of Israel, the dispersed Jews of Babylon and Persia, many of them stayed behind because they did not want to face the adversity and the hardship of transplanting and moving their families and possessions back to Israel. Consequently, they were more enmeshed in the things of the world. Whereas, generally speaking, the Jewish people who did leave Babylon and Persia, numbering about 40,000 to 45,000, did so for spiritual reasons, because they believed that the prophets, like Daniel and Jeremiah, they believed what God had told them, that their 70-year captivity in Babylon had come to a conclusion with the completion of 70 years, of course, and now God promised to bring them back into the land, and so forth. Jews in dispersion, however, are more secular in their outlook, and therefore not, and of course I'm speaking in general terms, and therefore they are not as spiritually attuned to the presence and providence of God. So maybe these are reasons why The name of God is never mentioned in Esther, nor is there any allusion to Him. The New Testament is silent also on the book of Esther. There is no quotation, allusion, or implied teaching from the book of Esther. But again, this does not rule out its canonicity as being part of Scripture and considered an inspired book of the Bible because, in the words of one Bible scholar, no other portion of the Bible is God's providential care of His people more evident than in the book of Esther. And we could say that for the Jewish people in diaspora for the last 2,000 years, though they faced terrible persecution, opposition, and many of them died among being scattered among the nations. Nevertheless, God protected them as His distinct people, and now in our day He's bringing them back to fulfill His plan for Israel as it directly centers upon the Messiah who is coming again to redeem them. Now, as we study the Feast of Purim as it is told in the Book of Esther, we have four personalities in the Book of Esther. First of all, we have Queen Esther herself. We have Mordecai, her uncle. We have the evil Haman who sought the destruction of the Jews. And we have King Xerxes of Persia. The story takes us to the 5th century BC. In 538 BC, many of the Jews in Persia chose to remain there rather than return to their homeland under the leadership of Nehemiah, Ezra, and Zerubbabel. Keep in mind, today, that would be the modern nation of Iran, where many of these Jews were when the Book of Esther starts. From this Jewish diaspora, we have Esther and Mordecai, the two courageous individuals of Purim. And we are told that both of them did not make it readily known that they were Jews due to the rampant anti-Semitism that was present in the Mesopotamia region, including Babylon and Persia. Esther's Persian name derives from the name of the pagan goddess, the Persian or Babylonian goddess of fertility, Ishtar. And Mordecai's name comes from the Babylonian god Marduk. And remember when Daniel and his three companions were taken to Babylon, they were also given Chaldean names. This was an attempt by their captors to assimilate them into the ancient pagan culture of that time. And though they took those names, nonetheless, they still practiced biblical Judaism as observant Jews. And we see this with Esther and Mordecai. Though they had Persian names, they were fervently for their people, and they were devoted to their destiny is God's chosen people. Esther's Hebrew name is Hadassah, and the word means myrtle, as in myrtle tree. And we are told in the opening chapters of Esther that she came from a tragic background growing up. For her parents died when she was a young girl. And her cousin Mordecai adopted her and raised her as his daughter, though he was considered to be her uncle as well. Mordecai held a high office in the Medo-Persian court, giving him constant access to the king and at his palace. He was probably a administrator of the king's financial or judicial affairs, because we are told that Mordecai was constantly in the presence of the king's gate. And in the ancient cities of the Middle East, the gates of the city, or just inside the gates, is where cases were heard by the local council of judges. So he might have been a legal administrator of Xerxes' kingdom. In spite of this, Mordecai maintained his Jewish identity. He was a Benjamite, according to Esther 2:5, of the same lineage as King Saul in the Old Testament and Saul, who became Paul in the New Testament. Then we have the evil anti-Semitic Haman. He is introduced to us, I believe, in the third chapter of Esther. He was an Agagite. Now, what is an Agagite? Well, again, we must go back to portions of the historical books and the Torah to find out what an Agagite is. An Agagite was simply one who was a descendant of Agag, the king of the Amalekites, who were placed under God's divine ban for their treacherous treatment and unprovoked attack against unarmed Israel when they passed through the Sinai under the leadership of Moses. The Amalekite people were a constant threat to Israel's dwelling in the Promised Land securely during the reign of King Saul, 1 Samuel 15:8. The Amalekite people were descendants of Amalek, who was the grandson of Esau, as we learn in Genesis 36:12. They were bitter enemies of Israel, and they carried on the ancient fraternal strife that existed between Jacob and Esau. And during the days of the Exodus, when Moses and Joshua brought the children of Israel out of Egypt and led them for 40 plus years, the Amalekites attacked unarmed Israel as they were passing through the Sinai, and they attempted to destroy and impede the Jewish people from going to and occupying the Promised Land. And for this, God never forgot their insidious hatred and their cruelty. And because of this, He pronounced a judgment on them that He would blot out. He would blot out the remembrance of Amalek and his descendants from under heaven. In other words, they were placed under the divine ban, as all of the seven peoples comprising the Canaanites were also. Remember the story when King Saul went to battle against the Amalekites, as the Lord through the prophet Samuel instructed. Saul was told, he was commanded by the Lord to destroy all the Amalekites, leaving none of them left to live. And Saul disobeyed, and the Amalekites were not annihilated, and some 600 years later, here they are again in the person of Haman, seeking the destruction of the Jewish people. And then lastly, our fourth person of prominence in the story of Esther is King Xerxes, King Xerxes. This king ruled from 485 to 465 BC. He was the king during Persia's period of decline from a mighty empire to a fading empire. His father, Darius, who is mentioned in Daniel 5 with his taking over and defeating the Babylons. His father, Darius, was defeated by Greeks at the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC. 10 years later, King Xerxes assembled a vast army to invade Greece and avenge his father's death. This was known as the Battle of Thermopylae. And eventually, King Xerxes was to lose the series of battles against the Greeks. And although he won the Battle of Thermopylae, he lost a subsequent battle and was routed by the Greek navy at the Battle of Salamis in 480 BC. Xerxes then retreated back to his palace in Persepolis, leaving behind an occupying army, which was defeated by the Greeks later on. After this, Xerxes withdrew from active political life, devoting himself to what the ancient historian Herodotus called the intrigues of the harem. 15 years later, Xerxes was stabbed to death by one of his servants, and he was succeeded to the throne by his son Artaxerxes. And so these are the four persons of prominence in the book of Esther dealing with the Feast of Purim. The immediate setting for the unfolding events, the book of Esther, was the king's palace in Shushan, or Susa. This was the Persian capital located just north of the Persian Gulf in what today is, ironically enough, modern Iran. And today we have a raging anti-Semite who follows in the same spirit of Haman, the current leader of Iran, who almost weekly makes threats to destroy Israel. And like Haman of old, if this Persian madman continues and is successful in acquiring nuclear weapons and their delivery systems, and he attempts to destroy Israel, he will bring destruction on himself and on his people, not learning or perhaps being ignorant of the example God made of Haman, who in Esther's day sought to destroy the chosen people and was himself destroyed. Well, we're out of time this time. We will pick up on our teaching of Purim next time. We are with you. And please, we would like to hear from you. The announcer will let you know how you can contact us at the end of this program. We covet your prayers and we ask for your financial support as we continue to educate the body of Christ about the Jewish roots of the Christian faith and take the gospel of Yeshua back to the Jewish people, His people, in the land of Israel. Until next time, Shalom Yeshua HaMashiach Alechem. May the peace of Jesus the Messiah be with you.